This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Stop and look around you right now. Chances are there's a computer or a phone or some other quote-unquote smart device in your vicinity. As our devices get more capable and we become more reliant on them, there's increasing hand-wringing over whether our relationships with technology have gone awry. In some circles, the conversation has a particular urgency to it because they're talking about whether or not robots could or should be entrusted with life and death decisions, and whether such robots could ever be conferred with anything comparable to our morals. The idea of creating robots with human attributes like intelligence or emotion has been around perhaps even longer than robots themselves, but that has recently taken on a slightly new twist. In May, the United States Office of Naval Research, or the ONR, announced a $7.5 million grant to study if or how a sense of moral decision-making could be imparted to autonomous machines from aerial drones to robotic caregivers. The five-year program includes researchers from Rensselaer Polytech, Tufts, Brown, Georgetown, and Yale. The goal is to create a morally robust robot, or good citizen robot. But there are questions about whether that is possible or even plausible. Reporter Christina Lindberg has this introduction to the debate.
While cleaning the company president's office, the custodian sat down at a desk and smoked a cigar.
He was thinking his boss wouldn't find out.
Here at the Brown University Cognitive, Linguistic, and Psychological Sciences Lab, Corey, one of Bertram Mala's graduate students, is demonstrating a human behavior experiment on the computer.
Shoveling the walkway.
Then a construction worker clogged up...
Mala is professor here at the Rhode Island Lab. He's also co-principal investigator of the ONR's Moral Reasoning Grant.
Because I'm fundamentally a psychologist, a cognitive scientist who studies humans, I want to much better understand human social behavior, human moral behavior, human moral competence. But I also hope that that understanding helps me and helps my colleagues to build better machines. They understand better how humans work, what makes them tick, and also have a moral sense, have some competence of acting appropriately.
Matthias Scheutze is the project's lead investigator and director of the Human Robot Interaction Laboratory at Tufts University. He says his long-time interest in moral competence, especially relating to robotics, has led him to consider many questions about developing and deploying autonomous robots.
Because there are multiple different aspects that I find worrisome about robot technology that we need to reflect on.
Scheutze's lab is currently home to at least two full-scale model robots, test subjects for their experiments. Andy is a PR2 robot over 5 feet tall. It, or he, as it's referred to by Scheutze's lab assistants, looks like a stout and outsized vacuum cleaner, but with chunky gray arms resting expectantly on its midsection. It has been trained to respond to lab assistant Brad's voice.
Commander Z needs a med kit.
Would you like to know where to find the medkit, or would you like me to bring Commander Z a medkit?
Scheutze says because robots can move around and interact with people, this can be troublesome down the road, especially for social robots and the problems they can pose. For instance, they can look like humans and pretend to have emotions that humans then respond to as if they were genuine emotions. They're not.
Because in the current state of the art, you don't have any kind of robot that is even close in capability to anything like a human emotion.
Still, many others argue that the dangers lurking from an asymmetrical emotional relationship with a robot pale in comparison with what could transpire because of machines or robots that could act as free agents within a military context.
And I'm very much a supporter of setting some limits up front about what is and what is not appropriate.
That's Wendell Wallach. He's head of the Technology and Ethics Study Group at Yale University and co-author of Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong.
In fact, I would go so far as to say that allowing machines to make life and death decisions about humans is a form of evil in itself.
He worries about the military applications of robots, with or without morals.
The problem is it doesn't really matter whether we trust our military or not, because this kind of weaponry is going to proliferate and be used in questionable ways by other countries. And that will also justify our escalating our own systems.
But Ron Arkin says there's an important role for robots in warfare, and that they could help to save human lives on the battlefield. That's why, he says, we need to talk about the pros and cons of ethical robots. Arkin is a professor in the College of Computing at Georgia Institute of Technology.
This technology is moving forward. It has the potential for good and it has the potential for evil. And it must be done, if it is to be moved forward, in a way which ensures that humanitarian interests, specifically with respect to non-combatants, are maintained.
Arkin says he does not subscribe to the notion that robots will be able to reason at the same level as humans, for instance, with respect to moral paradoxes.
What I do say is that they will be able to adhere to the laws of war and the rules of engagement which have been developed by human moral reasoning in ways in which human beings may fail. That's an important distinction.
And to that end, he says, a robot which has been programmed with a combination of specific constraints may, under certain circumstances, act even more ethically than humans would under those same circumstances. Specialized situations such as room clearing, counter-sniper operations, and perimeter protection along the demilitarized zone are some examples. Peter Asaro is co-founder of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control.
I think creating these ethical models and computational ethical models and seeing what you can do with them is an interesting research project. But I don't think we should confuse that with actual human moral reasoning and what humans are doing when they decide that it's a life is worth taking at a certain point in time.
And regardless of where opinion falls about the future role of technology, robots, and autonomous systems, everyone agrees public discussion and opinion can still make a difference in what that role will be. For WCAI, I'm Christina Lindborg.
And what that role will be and how we could get there are the questions before us today. Joining me to discuss, if not answer those questions, are Ron Arkin. He's a roboticist and roboethicist, a Regents Professor in the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Institute of Technology, an author of multiple textbooks, including Behavior-Based Robotics and Governing Lethal Behavior in Autonomous Robots. Ron Arkin, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also, Wendell Wallach. He's a consultant, ethicist, and scholar at Yale University's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. He chairs the center's working research group on technology and ethics, and he co-authored with Colin Allen the book Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong. Wendell Wallach, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, let's start with basics. What defines a robot? I mean, I think we have this concept in our minds of this sort of tin can looking thing that walks around, a very science fiction idea of what a robot is. But in fact, some robots don't even have a body. They are just autonomous software working on the internet. So is there a single definition of a robot at this point? Ron Arkin.
Well, there are many definitions for robots. I would argue that the one that you talk about that is sometimes referred to as a robot that is trolling on the internet and the like is often referred to as a softbot. Most of the robots, and I think the ones that we'll be talking about here, have an embodiment. They physically exist within the real world. And the definition that I've used in my text is an intelligent machine is able to extract information from its environment and use knowledge about its world to move safely in a meaningful and purposeful manner. Basically, it can sense, it can act, and if information is available, it can plan.
Wendell Wallach, are there robots, according to that definition, in our lives today?
Well, there certainly are robots in our lives today, and we're seeing more and more proliferation of them. As far as making ethical decisions, or at least explicit ethical decisions, that's really a very new field. The kinds of ethical decisions that robots make today are more or less hard programmed in by the designers and engineers who build them, who more or less can psych out what situations the robots will encounter and therefore what appropriate response they should make in those situations.
Can you give us some examples of where we're seeing robots attempting to make decisions in the real world today?
Well, things as simple as robots navigating through corridors in hospitals or in libraries or museums as guides. They have to make decisions about not bumping into people that they perceive along their pathways.
Now, Ron Arkin, we have plenty of what we call smart devices, but what does it mean for a robot truly to be intelligent?
Well, there is a definition of artificial intelligence, which is often called the ever-vanishing horizon definition of AI. Back in 1939, around the World's Fair, toasters were actually considered to be robots because they could sense the state of the bread, whether how hot it was or how brown it was, and act by simply popping it up. Clearly, we don't consider toasters robots anymore. But this notion, again, of being able to sense and to act, which leads us to ever more complex scenarios in the ways in which these systems can perform, is where robotics continues to head. We see them in healthcare. We see them in surgery. We see them in a variety of different ways. But I think the underlying characteristics which defines the discussion is autonomy, this notion of autonomous robots. And it's important to point out from the beginning, we are not talking, at least I am not talking, about philosophical autonomy, which is the notion of robots having free will or moral agency. That is so far beyond the grasp of robotics at this point in time, it doesn't really make sense to talk about it from my point of view. But rather, we are talking about autonomy, as Wendell described, as being able to embed certain characteristics of morality or other ways in which to act, which are consistent with human expectations, in some cases, laws.
Would you agree with that, Wendell Wallach?
Yes. To build on that, I really think of autonomy as little more than actions that robots take without humans directly engaged in that situation. So there are all kinds of forms of autonomy we already see, but they're limited autonomy.
So would you consider morality to be a subset, I guess, a specific case of intelligence? Or is this something that the attempt to create a moral robot, does that go even beyond the effort to create artificial intelligence? Wendell Wallach.
It's very complicated in terms of what kinds of situations you're talking about robots being moral. If we're talking about robots being moral in the sense of just taking an appropriate action in some relatively simple situation where they might encounter two or three choices, then I would say, yes, it's a subset of artificial intelligence. But there's another way of thinking about moral decision making where it almost transcends our basic definitions of artificial intelligence and maybe the embodiment of being a really intelligent robot. So things like moral intelligence, emotional intelligence, consciousness, these are sort of the far horizons of what artificial intelligence might aspire to or might really be necessary for a machine to fully embody artificial intelligence.
Now, Ron Arkin, you said that talking about true autonomy, and I would assume that means also moral autonomy, is beyond the scope of what we should even be talking about. But at the same time, you've said that you see this as imperative to work on developing because it's going to be an inevitable need. So how do you balance those two?
Okay, well, it's not exactly imperative to work on that aspect of autonomy. What is imperative to work upon is making sure that the machines that we create, whether they be toasters or whether they be warfighters, to make sure that they adhere to the underlying principle that humanity has agreed upon is the right way to act. Not giving full moral autonomy and the ability of a robot to do full moral reasoning comparable to a human being, which, again, I mentioned is beyond the scope of our capability any time near soon, ascribes responsibility to the robot itself for making its own decisions. In other words, it's the robot's fault if something goes wrong. There is no way we are ever close at any time that I can envision, which speaks to the singularity question when machine intelligence exceeds human intelligence for those who are futurists, less so perhaps for the roboticists that I associate with. The question is then, how do we define morality in something in the near and midterm, which are the pressing questions both from the military point of view and the social point of view, in my mind? Responsibility must always vest with a human being, and no one can ever say, the robot did it, and I'm off the hook.
We will talk more about the ethical questions and the philosophical questions that this raises, but I want to step back for a moment to the technical. I mean, at some level, you have to be essentially mimicking the human brain, I would assume, in order to create an intelligent robot. Is that what we're working at doing, mimicking the human brain? Or are we trying to create some other construct? And where is the state of our ability or knowledge in doing so?
What most people fail to realize is that there are many trajectories in robotics and attempts to mimic the human brain or at least mimic facets of it is exactly what some roboticists are focusing on. But most roboticists are focusing on getting the robots to do what they want them to do in very practical situations. And whether or not they mimic the human brain or go through a very different procedure or very different way of doing things than the humans would do that, that really depends upon the decisions of the engineer in terms of what is the best course for them to pursue.
Ron Arkin, where do you think the state of our ability lies? I mean, you've said a couple of times now that you don't think this is something we will be able to do in the foreseeable future. Do you think never, or is this something we are realistically working toward?
Well, never say never is something that you should, I believe, adhere to, including myself. But the issue is whether it's long-term or not. And should we be working towards it? Sure, we should be working towards it in the sense of developing a better understanding of human moral reasoning. Again, my colleagues at Tufts and elsewhere that led off that a tape that you had at the beginning described some of the questions, and they're exploring folk morality and other aspects as well, too, the use of deontic logic and other ways in which they can determine ways in which human morality is processed. That's an important goal. There is no doubt about that. Whether we will have robots to be able to accomplish that anytime soon is a different question. My work has been profoundly influenced by neuroscience and ethology and other forms of bio-inspired systems, which we use, but we make no claims or we do not feel limited by the ways in which biological systems operate to creating artificial emotions, as was referred to earlier, or artificial morality, if I was pursuing that particular goal.
That's Ron Arkin of Georgia Institute of Technology. Also with us, Wendell Wallach of Yale University. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about the prospect of robots with the capacity to make moral decisions on their own. My guests are both experts in this field. Ron Arkin is a Regents Professor in the School of Interactive Computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology and author of multiple advanced robotics textbooks. Wendell Wallach chairs a working research group on technology and ethics at Yale University's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. He's also co-author of Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong. For many of us, though, our views on what robots could or should do may have been largely shaped by science fiction. Human-like robots have been cropping up in books and movies for decades, and robots gone bad are a recurring theme. Let's take a quick listen to a few examples.
Knight Rider, a shadowy flight into the dangerous world of a man who does not exist.
Murder's a new trick for a robot. Congratulations. Respond.
What does this action signify? What does it mean?
It's a sign of trust. It's a human thing. You wouldn't understand.
It can't be reasoned with. It will feel no pity, no remorse, no pain, no fear. This weapon will be called the Terminator.
I'm an android. Lieutenant Commander Data.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Well done, R2. I knew you could do it. Hello. I am C-3PO, human-cyborg relations, and this is my counterpart, R2-D2.
Ron Arkin, I know you don't like to mingle science fiction and reality, but these popular depictions of robots, in many cases gone bad, demonstrates, I think, a deep-seated fear about the perils of going down this route, of trying to create robots with intelligence and other increasingly human characteristics. Is catastrophe, is a robot gone bad or an evil robot an inevitable outcome of attempting to go this route?
Well, we can thank Mary Shelley for Frankenstein, which started much of the Western thinking in this particular space. Are there potential dystopian futures? Certainly. Things can go bad. That's one of the reasons why Wendell and myself and many others are spending a lot of time talking about these particular issues, to find ways to ensure that a not utopian, but at least a not a dystopian future occurs. Ideally, it would be utopian, of course, but that's a different story. How we can find ways to make these systems contribute meaningfully and well to humanity. It's not an easy task to be able to understand all the potential futures that exist. Science fiction helps us. I love science fiction. I love those movies, virtually every one that you had. And there's another one coming out. One of my students just pointed out this morning. This is a plug for it, I guess, although I haven't seen it, called Automata, which, again, it looks like robots gone bad. It's intriguing. It's interesting. But does it really depict the futures that we necessarily are going to have? I think we need to work to make sure that those indeed do not occur.
And you think it would be possible to avert that?
There's always a possibility that something can go wrong ever since we started making tools. I mean, if you go back to, 2001, the very first scene where the, I can't even remember exactly what kind of animal that was, an ape of some sort, threw the thing up into the air and it suddenly became a space station. We are tool makers. We are tool makers as a species. Are there dangers associated with that? Yes.
Wendell Wallach, in your book, Moral Machines, you predict an inevitable catastrophe in the near future brought about by robotics. What do you foresee happening?
Well, let's be clear here. There's a great deal of difference between these far future science fiction scenarios and what we were trying to allude to. We were trying to allude to more near-term things that could go wrong as we adopt increasing complex systems and forms of artificial intelligence that make decisions for us. So Ron and I more or less agree that the science fiction is pretty far out there, and yet the waters get muddied in this particular discussion because there's a number of people saying that, well, we're only 20 or 30 or maybe 50 years away from creating forms of artificial intelligence that are much more intelligent than we humans are, that have super intelligence. And I do not believe that those time frames are meaningful, and I would hate to try and predict what would happen in 1 or 200 years. In fact, I'm loath to predict what could happen in 15 or 20 years. There's so much unpredictable about how the emerging technologies, not just robotics, are going to unfold. But what we were alluding to in our book, and I had actually made the prediction a couple years before the book came out, was that the ways in which we are turning over more and more tasks to machines, things can go wrong that we aren't paying attention to. So actually, the month after I first made this prediction, there was a failure of a semi-autonomous cannon in South Africa, and it killed 7 soldiers and injured, I believe it was, 11 others. Soon after our book, we had the failures in Wall Street around the real estate crisis. And most people don't fully understand the role of computers in that, but part of the real estate crisis was due to these derivatives, these difficult to assemble bundles of different properties, different loans, and the inability for anyone to understand who owned what properties or who owned what portions of properties. So even the bankers did not know what the worth of their banks were when the real estate crisis took place. So we were alluding more to these near-term concerns about how robots are involved in our life, or at least in this case not necessarily robots but computers, the bots in computers, in making decisions and taking actions that could lead to human harms.
You're listening to Living Lab. That's Wendell Wallach of Yale University. Also with me, Ron Arkin of the Georgia Institute of Technology. We're talking about whether it would be possible or even desirable to create robots with a sense of morals. Now, Ron Arkin, a lot of the debate at this point is being driven by the military. This past May, the United Nations hosted a first-of-its-kind conference on how to set guidelines for lethal autonomous weapons, essentially robotic weapons. And more than 90 of the 117 participating states that make up the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, which I don't know how robots fit into conventional weapons, but they met in Geneva. to bring this issue to the table. So what is the conversation at this point within the military? What is the driving force to try to have robots with morals in the military?
I had the privilege of being one of the experts that had the opportunity to testify in front of the United Nations at that meeting, and it was a seminal meeting. Again, the real question is that was brought there is, do we need to talk about this further? And that will be decided, I believe, this coming November at a subsequent meeting. There are other things. The United States has issued a Department of Defense directive, which actually restricts the use of certain classes of autonomous system, and effectively, in a quasi-moratorium, prohibits their development and deployment over the next 10 years, those that would particularly target individual humans, for example. Other classes of systems which could be used against materiel, things like incoming grenades and other things, are permitted to continue to be used. The potential applications of this technology are manifold. And what's most important from my point of view is recognizing that we need not necessarily to ban the technology outright as a platform, as some are choosing to do, but rather restrict the uses and understand where it can potentially have benefits and where it poses the greatest risks and the like. There are risks associated with this, and we should, I believe, have a moratorium to restrict the use of these systems until we better understand how they can be deployed.
We already have drones that are carrying out attacks, but with a human being behind the scenes making those final decisions about whether or not an attack should be carried out on a particular target. This, what you're talking about is those drones essentially being able to decide for themselves whether or not to carry out the attack. Why would that be preferable?
Well, there's several reasons why it would be preferable under certain circumstances. Again, you can't talk about it in the general sense. In many cases, I would never advocate that we turn over the autonomy that is exercised by the human pilots in these remotely piloted vehicles, as the Air Force prefers to call them, in Nevada and the like, because under current mission criteria, there's plenty of time to make the decision as to whether to engage the target. You can have more than a single human being, their eyes on target. You may even be able to ask human legal counsel at this point in time before you engage the target. So certain uses, I would argue that we shouldn't use autonomy in every possible case. But in other situations, such as a system that is being developed by Lockheed Martin, which is underdeveloped and funded by DARPA, which has, I have a brochure in front of me talking about it, it has an offensive anti-surface warfare weapon capability. It's called the LRASM, the long-range anti-ship missile. And it states in its description from Lockheed Martin, this autonomous capability means the weapon can use gross target queuing data to locate, track, and attack its target in denied environments. This is a real important question for things like cruise missiles or drones, as you refer to them. When suddenly, against a more technologically sophisticated enemy, the link back to Creech Air Force Base goes down. The GPS happens to be denied. Does that mean the system has to just go around in a circle and not engage its target? Or are we going to be able to do that effectively? That's the military's point of view. My point of view is that we need to find ways to deal with non-combatant casualties, because the status quo with respect to innocent civilian casualties is utterly and wholly unacceptable, is clearly evidenced in almost every conflict that's current today, whether it be Ukraine, Gaza, Afghanistan, or with ISIS, or Africa. The situations there are completely unacceptable, and technology can, must, and should play a role in trying to find ways to reduce this collateral damage, or in some cases, war crimes.
Wendell Wallach, respond to that. Technology should and must play a role and could provide significant benefits in terms of human lives saved in war. Could the benefits of autonomous robots outweigh the potential perils?
Well, my concern is that the short-term benefits may be far outweighed by the long-term consequences of going down this road. So that's largely where Ron and I differ in some significant ways. I agree that if semi-autonomous weapons can be used in a way in which humans are still in the loop, that's probably entirely acceptable, and it's certainly acceptable to use autonomous weaponry and defensive capabilities as we are doing already. But my concern is whether we're moving down the slope where the humans are not really in the loop anymore and the machines are starting to make the life and death decisions, and whether that could, for example, cause more deaths because we entered into a war that we had not intended to enter into. So the issue here from a military perspective is robust command and control. But the perspective, but the issue here from an international perspective is whether there is an inflection point at this point in, at this time in history where we can stop or at least slow down the development of robotics that might become more and more autonomous in warfare like or war situations, and whether we should take that action at this juncture in history. And here's where Ron and I differ subtly. I believe that inflection point is here. He more or less believes that we're inevitably going down this road where autonomous weaponry, killing machines is inevitable. We're not going to be able to stop that.
Ron Arkin, is that your sense that this is inevitably coming?
Well, one of the reasons I believe and say it is inevitable, unless restricted by international humanitarian law, there's always that clause that has to be attached to that. But one of the reasons I believe it's inevitable is these systems already exist. They are already fielded. They have existed for decades. They are things like the Phalanx system on Aegis-class cruisers, where the commander basically just turns the system into auto mode operation, and then it has to protect itself against a sea-skimming surface missile, which... you cannot ask the commander, should I fire at that point in time, because you're dead in the water, literally, under those circumstances. Certain types of anti-tank mines and other kinds of mines as well, too. Not the anti-personnel mines, which are generally considered immoral due to their inability to discriminate civilian from non-combatant, non-combatant from combatant. But these kinds of mines use seismic signatures and infrared signatures, cruise missiles, Patriot missiles. All of these things, at some level, at least fit my definition of autonomy, which is basically the ability to pull a trigger to attack a selected target without human initiation or confirmation, both in the case of target choice or attack command. These are not terminators. These are existing systems which can attack submarines, can attack surface systems. They already exist.
And, Wendell Wallach, there are other systems outside of warfare which could be making essentially life or death decisions, not so much in the sense of directly should I kill an individual, but in the sense that actions could affect whether or not a person continues to live, whether you've got a robot as a perhaps a caregiver for the elderly or as a caregiver for a child, even things like the self-driving cars that are under development. So this is not just about killer robots.
No, it's not just about killer robots. And that's why I try and draw out what is at stake in the question of whether we bring international humanitarian law into play in restricting robots that make life and death decisions about humans. I fully acknowledge that we have robots making defensive decisions already. There's no question about that. But my broader concern is whether we're moving down a slope where humans are abrogating responsibility, whether robots, whether increasingly autonomous robots could undermine the fundamental principle that there's a human who's responsible and potentially culpable and liable for the decisions that are being made. So that's more a long-term concern, but it does come up in healthcare decisions, in decisions where you might have service robots taking care of the homebound and elderly. And that's where we get into the greater nuances about what kinds of decisions can these machines make, to what extent is their decision-making just an extension of human will and intention, or might it diverge from what is our human intention and what we're willing to take responsibility for?
Now, Ron Arkin, at the very beginning of the show, you mentioned the idea that robots should adhere to the universal human code of good behavior. But I don't really see that there is a universal code of good behavior. Whose morals would you confer to your robot? And couldn't different nations or groups confer completely different morals to their robots?
I guess I missed that part because when you dialed in, I hadn't heard myself say that, because I agree with you. I don't know what a universal code of good behavior is. I do want to know what philosophers and theologists and lawyers have thought about for thousands of years and hundreds of years that have resulted in just war theory, and have which have been embodied to some degree in international humanitarian law and to some degree human rights law. One thing, in terms of understanding ethical strategies, especially when you get away from the military domain, I agree. There are relatively few things, and this is an important point as well, too, which Wendell speaks to in his Malensay arguments, that some things are evil in themselves. Indeed, there are some things, such as murder, rape, thievery. Those things are generally universally condemned and could lead to certain applications in robotic systems. I will disagree with him about a platform being evil in itself. I will say rather that what's evil in itself is the ongoing, continuing suffering that innocent civilian casualties are receiving in the battle space. But there are cultural differences. If you look at social morality, how it's changed, where it used to be that the only people that were considered human beings, at least in Western culture, were white property owners. This has clearly changed with suffrage and many other things as well, too, to the correct, in my view, current definition. But this may be expanded to animals. It may be expanded to robot rights in the future as well, too. I'm not sure that's a wise idea, but it's something that we should talk about.
That's Ron Arkins, a Regents Professor in the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Institute of Technology. Also with me, Wendell Wallach. He chairs a working research group on technology and ethics at Yale University's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. We'll talk more about the promise and pitfalls of attempting to create robots with morals or ethics when we get back after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. If we wanted to create robots with morals, and if we could, those are both two big ifs, whose morals would we give them, and how would we go about doing that? With me to discuss these issues is Ron Arkin, a Regents Professor in the School of Interactive Computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and Wendell Wallach, the chair of a working research group on technology and ethics at Yale University's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. Wendell Wallach, in terms of whose ethics or whose morals we might try to confer to robots, Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics come to mind. And this was three laws that basically, all taken together, say that a robot may not injure or harm or allow a human to come to harm, that essentially robots need to be in a supportive or protective role with regard to humans. And he then later added a fourth, or actually he called it the zeroth rule, that this would pertain to all of humanity. Could Asimov's laws of robotics be a guiding principle in reality, not only in science fiction?
Well, Asimov's laws, I certainly would come first to mind whenever people encounter this subject. And they say, didn't Asimov already solve this problem? But if you look at Asimov's stories, nearly every one of them shows how a robot programmed with these rather straightforward laws, obey humans, protect humans, and then engage in self-preservation, arranged hierarchically, so one trumps two and three and two trumps three, that in nearly every one of his stories shows how there would be a breakdown in those kinds of robots. They would not know what to do, for example, when they got two commands from different humans that conflicted with each other. So Asimov, if anything, probably showed that a strict law-based morality is not effective in building robots that are truly ethical. And it's important to note, given our previous discussion, that the first law is not to harm humans. So that's a non-starter when we talk about the use of robots in warfare.
Ron Arkin, in a lot of the science fiction scenarios where essentially a robot created to be moral goes immoral, it happens because the robot is so intelligent and so autonomous that it's able to learn and make decisions for itself about whether or not it believes in the morals with which it was programmed. Is such a scenario possible if we are creating robots with a degree of intelligence themselves? Could they essentially change their morals on us?
Well, that speaks to the issue of machine learning. But one quick thing on the last comment that Wendell made. The zeroth law, which was added considerably later by Asimov, does allow for a robot to hurt a human being if it's at the benefit for all of humanity. This dealt with when an entire planet was going to be destroyed. So one would argue he tempered his original laws, but I'm not speaking to that right now.
But that just brings up what a gray area all of this is, and how on earth would we program such subtlety into a machine?
Well, you wouldn't use it with Asimov's laws is one thing as well, too. I've often called the laws of war and the ability to create, and if you will, an ethical military robot, the low-hanging fruit, because that has international agreement. It has accords. It still is hard to do, and I'm not saying it's going to be anytime soon. I do project that even if there was a full-up effort to be able to do that, it would take a minimum of 10 to 20 years. But the morality that varies from culture to culture, even from person to person. I mean, we can't even agree on abortion, for example, as to what is right and what is wrong as a nation. So how do we find a robot that can be able to come up with the right answer, if you will, for that particular question? Those are incredibly difficult and challenging problems. They affect the nature and type of the moral framework that you use, whether it be rights-based or deontological, whether it be consequentialist or outcome-based or utilitarian, whether it be a social or virtue ethics. All kinds of frameworks are being investigated to try and address these particular problems. And they do lead, in many cases, to different outcomes. But if the robot is allowed, and this worries me in military robots, and I could support banning certain aspects of machine learning in the context of what I'll call in situ or in the field learning for these kinds of platforms where they are allowed to develop and understand their own targets on the fly. Those are things that really worry me at this point in time, let alone the morphing, if you will, of an ethical code that a robot might have.
Could you argue in whether or not we create these technologies that there are already people, human beings, who do not adhere to even the most universal of moral codes? There are people who commit murder and rape and these other horrible crimes. That by creating a robot that was perhaps capable of those, are we introducing something more evil, or are we essentially just creating another player in the human moral game?
I think the difficulty with all this discussion is that we focus right immediately upon those issues that we disagree on, and we call those the salient moral issues, or we focus immediately on those who don't even follow what are generally accepted broadly as principles that are perhaps accepted across most cultures. So I actually look at this discussion a little bit differently. I think morality, or at least ethics, is anything in which values come into play in a decision making, and the decisions are sometimes very low, simple decisions about do you do X or do you do Y, and depending upon which values you bring into play will determine which of those choices you make. So in many ways, what we're talking about in ethical decision making is just designing the robots so that when they come into circumstances where they have to make explicit moral decisions, they more or less come up with the action plan that good actors, wise actors, would also follow, but not getting too caught up in these issues about, well, should you abort or should you not abort? We're way too early to even consider bringing those kinds of decisions into the lives of robots.
Wendell Wallach, let's talk for a moment about how we might go about actually doing the programming. And there are a couple of different approaches that could lead to different outcomes in terms of the type of morality that a robot might exhibit. So what are the different approaches that we could take to try to create the underlying programming for morality?
Well, we talked in our book about top-down, bottom-up, top-down approaches, bottom-up approaches, and an additional factor that we called super-rational faculties. So a top-down approach is an approach where you more or less program into the robot some set of values that should help it determine, that become part of its control architecture in determining what choices and actions it takes. So a top-down theory could be the Ten Commandments, could be Asimov's laws, could be consequentialism, could be Kant's categorical imperative. There are so many different sets of values or procedures or principles that could inform a top-down approach. A bottom-up approach, the easiest way of thinking about that is the learning of a child, where it doesn't necessarily come into the world understanding morality, but it learns through education and experience. So there's these questions about whether we could take an infant mind, an infant robot mind, through a kind of process where it learned about acting morally. But when you think about either top-down or bottom-up, they may be insufficient to get the robot to function appropriately in all circumstances. And one of the reasons I find this subject area so fascinating is because it makes us think very deeply about how we humans make moral decisions and whether reason is enough in the making of moral decisions. So there may be these extra faculties, we call them beyond reason or super-rational faculties, like consciousness, like being able to determine the beliefs and goals of others, like emotional intelligence, like being embodied in a world, like being a sociable creature, that enter into the moral decision-making process and need to be there if a machine is going to be able to make more and more sophisticated moral decisions.
As technology plays more and more of a role in our daily lives, and even just with the technologies we currently have, our phones, our computers, there's also already a lot of hand-wringing about whether or not this is changing the nature of our interpersonal relationships and even, to some degree, the nature of our humanity. Would creating autonomous, intelligent, potentially moral robots make us in any way less human, denigrate our humanity, Wendell Wallach?
Well, I think there is a concern here, and I don't think it's just about robots. I think it's the increasing language that talks about humans in terms of, oh, that we are machine-like or we are just evolved creatures or that we are flawed creatures. There is this kind of challenge about whether our humanity is getting enriched by the courses we're going down scientifically or whether, in a sense, it may be contributing to self-doubt in some humans or at least ways of looking at what it means to be human that doesn't necessarily embrace our better qualities. So we talk more about the flaws in human nature than really the richness of human capabilities.
Ron Arkin, we have less than a minute. I just want to say, do you think that these robots could enrich us or would these robots be a detriment to humanity?
I think they can do both. Again, we have the potential for dystopian futures, as was mentioned earlier, but we are studying as well, too, leveraging some of the work we did for the military in the management of early-stage Parkinson's caregiver-patient relationships in the presence of something called facial masking, using techniques which represent the understanding of one agent to another called theory of mind. We're trying to preserve the dignity. We're using moral emotions in these systems, such as empathy and the fostering empathy and reducing shame and embarrassment in the patient.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. That's Ron Arkins of Georgia Institute of Technology, Wendell Wallach of Yale University. Thank you to both of you. This is Living Lab. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.